I'm going to start in a few minutes. I'll just put it on my Facebook, so just want to let everyone know we'll start in a couple of minutes. Hi, Melanie.
Morning, Rabbi.
You're doing well, you're doing well. Very good.
I'll tell you what. I'm pleased you can hear me today, at least. I always feel lost in translation.
Yeah, no problem. Although what I might do is at the beginning, I'm going to mute everyone just in case there's background noise. And if you want to ask a question, you can just unmute yourself.
Anyway, thank you again.
Pleasure, pleasure.
At least I'm on time.
That's great.
I actually thought today was a parasha. I must have looked at the wrong date.
No. We changed it for today. So we're doing just the regular. We're doing at 10 o'clock. We're doing insights into the Haggadah. We're going to start just for those watching Facebook or Zoom. We're going to start in a couple of minutes. Just waiting until 10 o'clock, and then we're going to kick off.
Sandy.
Okay, 1 more minute, I just don't want to start early, so I'm going to wait another minute and then we'll start. Okay, welcome everyone. What we're going to do today is do some insights into the Haggadah. So the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to share with you three sort of shorter insights on the different parts of the Haggadah and then explore a bit of a deeper idea into the whole way that matzah is referred to in the Haggadah, and sort of exploring and going into a bit of the depth of the mitzvah of matzah, of eating matzah on Pesach night. Okay, so I'm going to start just with a random thing here. The one of the customs that we have on the Seder plate, of course, is to have an egg, a boiled egg, and then later on, the boiled egg is, of course, in memory of the additional sacrifice that was brought on Pesach besides the Paschal lamb. So we have the shank bone to remember the Paschal lamb, the Korban Pesach, and then we have the egg, which reminds us of the additional Korban, the other reasons for the egg as well, which was brought also on Erev Pesach. The reason that they ate a second sacrifice at the meal in the time of the temple, time of the Beis HaMikdash, was because the Korban Pesach, similar to the way we do the Afikoman today, it needs to be eaten when we're actually full, we're not hungry. So we eat it when we're already satisfied. So therefore, at the time of the temple, they would eat for main course, they would eat the korban chagiga, the chagiga korban, the chagiga sacrifice, and then for the afikoman, for the end of the meal, they would eat the korban pesach, which we do for the.
A lot of repetition from all the rabbis.
I'm sorry. What's that? If anyone, if there's background noise, you just don't mind muting yourselves, and then if you want to ask a question, you can unmute. Okay, so that's where it was done. Now, There's also a custom later on in the meal, that's when we come to the meal, although this is not halakhically required, but there's a custom at the beginning of the meal to actually eat the egg in salt water, whatever the case is. Some people make a big deal out of it, make a whole soup out of it, and so on and so forth. So there's quite a focus on the egg, even though it's not one of the mandatory mitzvahs of Pesach night, but there's a big focus on the egg. So I wanted to share with you an insight of why specifically an egg, an insight from, I always like this insight because I have his Agoda, the Ishbitzer Rebbe. I have a Haggadah from him. He's one of my ancestors, so I always like to read his material. And he says a very beautiful thing on the egg. We have mentioned it in past years, but I want to mention it again because it's a very beautiful idea. He says the following. An egg is an interesting type of food, meaning like this. It's the only food that works like this. When an egg is born, when an egg is laid, I should say, it's ready to eat. In other words, it's an acceptable food. You can make a hard-boiled egg, you can make a fried egg, you can make a sunny side up, you can eat it, you can enjoy it, and so on and so forth. Yet, intrinsically, the purpose of an egg is actually very unfinished when it's laid, because the purpose of the egg is really then to continue on, to be incubated, and to hatch into a chicken. So in other words, what really happens with an egg is it's enjoyed, it's complete on one level when it's laid, yet it's lacking completeness because it still needs to, its real purpose is to continue on and to hatch into a chicken. So he says very much is the same with the going Exodus from Egypt, and very much is therefore how we understand the whole process of Exodus from Egypt. He says the following, we know that the ultimate state, the ultimate redemption that will take place for the world and for the Jewish people is redemption through Mashiach. The ultimate, the messianic redemption which will come hopefully very soon. We also know that the concept of redemption was born when the Jews left Egypt. In other words, when Mashiach comes, when there will be the ultimate messianic revelation and the redemption, that redemption has its origin, has its source in the redemption from Egypt. Which that means, therefore, the redemption from Egypt, he says, is like an egg. In other words, when we left Egypt, the concept of redemption was born, and at that level was a perfect redemption. It was redemption where we became intrinsically free. We no longer had the definition of being spiritually enslaved. We were now free people. That's an eternal freedom which we got in Egypt. It was a very complete thing and a thing which can be enjoyed as it is. However, it's like an egg which has a further purpose. It has a further purpose, and therefore the further purpose can actually still needs to take place. So therefore it was complete but incomplete, just like an egg. It's complete but incomplete. So in other words, it still needs the complete redemption, which is redemption through Mashiach, which will come through that final redemption. But the truth is, that's not just about the two redemptions, it's also about us. We know that when we sit at the Seder, we actually are not just celebrating history, but we're actually experiencing history, as we said many, many times. So the concept of sitting at the Seder is to experience personal freedom. The whole idea is that in every generation we're supposed to see ourselves as if we are going out of Egypt, as the Haggadah says. In other words, the whole idea is that we all have our limitations, we all have our personal mitzrayim, we all have our own personal incarceration, limitation, and the whole concept of Pesach is to learn to go beyond our own limitation. We need to free ourselves from ourselves. We need to go out of our comfort zone. We have to take a step beyond our comfort zone. Spiritually grow, emotionally grow, become a better person, do an extra mitzvah, whatever that Exodus means, each person in their own context, because each person's Egypt is different to the other, each person's redemption is different to the other. So when it comes to Pesach, we are given that energy, we are given that blessing, we are given that gift of being able to go beyond ourselves and to be able to experience our own personal mitzrayim. But when we sit down to the Seder, which is the main time that we actually celebrate and experience that concept of freedom, that's the main time that gift is given to us, that energy is given to us. When that happens, we have to remember the lesson of the egg. In other words, we went out of Egypt last year, and last year's Egypt, last year's Exodus was amazing, but it was like an egg, because it still gives room for a further freedom. In other words, it's eternal. We keep going out of Egypt because this is the rule. The rule is that today's redemption is tomorrow's Egypt. Today's Exodus is tomorrow's Mitzrayim. In other words, so therefore this year, we will become free. We'll take another step. We'll go beyond our comfort zone. But remembering that that is an egg. It's celebrated. It needs to be celebrated. It's celebrated on Pesach. But then we need to know that as time goes on, we need to take a further step. We cannot become complacent and satisfied with our current exodus. We need to keep going and move on like the egg that eventually hatches into a chicken. And that's a very important perspective. We have to celebrate the freedom that we achieve, but yet remember that there's still further to go, which we hopeful will keep going as the year goes on. And we never stop growing. We never stop going out of Egypt. Every generation, every day, every moment, we keep growing until the ultimate and final revelation, as the Ishvitzer says, which will be through the Tom Mashiach.
I can't see it, but I've got you here.
That's good. You keep listening.
I can't help it.
Sorry, if you just want to mute yourself, you don't mind, or just don't talk because it's a background noise. Okay, so the second thought I want to share with you follows on, because in fact in the Haggadah we do mention this concept. We do mention this idea that b'chol dor v'dor, every generation we need to see ourselves as if we are going out of Egypt. Now, what does that mean? So simply it means, as we just said before, that we have to experience freedom, we have to experience Exodus every single generation. But I want to just share with you a little insight that the Mojitzer Rebbe says. This is also, I found, I have, thank God, a large collection of Haggadot with different commentary. And one of them I inherited from my grandfather's library after he passed away. And I realized that it was printed in New York just after the war. There was printed a Haggadah with two commentaries from two Mojitzer Rebbes. And one of the Mojitzer Rebbes says the following. He says, what do we learn from the fact that in every generation we have to go out of Egypt? Why don't we just say that in every generation we have to grow, we have to become free? What's the emphasis on the exodus from Egypt? He says, a beautiful idea. He says, in every generation we have to experience the exodus specifically from Egypt. Why? Because he says we have to remember that just like in Egypt, we are taught by our sages that the Jews had reached a very low level of impurity. In fact, we are taught that there are 50 levels of impurity and they had reached rock bottom. They were on the 49th level because had they reached the 50th level, that would be too much. There would be a point of no return. God took them out just in time and saved them from complete immersion and complete imprisonment in the concept of impurity. But they were pretty low. They were assimilated. We know the Talmud says that the Jews even served idols in Egypt. They were pretty spiritually low. To the point where when they came to the Yamsuf, when they came to the sea, the Talmud, the Gemara tells us that the Malachim, the angels in heaven, turned to God and says, why are you favoring one nation over the other? Why do you want to save the Jews and drown the Egyptians? Halalu ovde avodazara, halalu ovde avodazara. These are serving idols and these are serving idols. They're both in the same boat. Why do you favor the one over the other? But of course, God had made a covenant with Abraham. We were his people. At the end of the day, he had promised us to take us out and to give us the Torah. But nevertheless, we were pretty low. And yet, God gave us the gift of freedom. Says the Mojitzer, b'chol dor v'dor. Remember this in every generation. No matter how a person might define themselves. Sometimes we think to ourselves, you know, we're trapped. We have a bad personality. People say, well, you know, yes, why are you upset that I'm losing my temper? That's just me. I'm an angry person, I cannot help it. I'm an unkind person, I'm an impatient person. Whatever the case is, this mitzvah is just not for me. I'm too old for this, I cannot grow, I cannot take the next step. I'm too stuck in where I am. Says the Haggadah, b'chol dor v'dor, remember the exodus from Egypt. And in every generation you can do the same thing, because just like in Egypt, they were pretty stuck. They were steeped into the 49th level of impurity. Yet, God says, I'll take you out. This Pesach, God takes us out. So even if you look at yourself unfavorably and you think you're very stuck in your weaknesses, you're very stuck in your shortcomings, and growth is not something you can do, personal freedom is not something you can experience, the Haggadah says that's not true. B'chol dor v'dor, in every generation, we re-experience exactly the same thing. We might be very low, but we can do it. That's another little insight. Before I explore the concept of matzah, I'm going to share with you one further idea, which I know I've shared previously in the past, but just an important idea. And again, it emphasizes our ability to actually grow and become and experience our personal freedom. I'll just go into a little bit. You know, we have the famous passage in the Haggadah where we talk about the story of Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah. It's a passage which emphasizes the concept that every single day, actually, we're supposed to mention Yitziat Mitzrayim. When do we do that? We actually do it in the third paragraph of Shema, and we do it daily. And Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah was of the opinion that not only do we need to do it daily, But we need to do it twice a day, once in the morning and once at night. Whenever we read Shema, the morning Shema and the evening Shema, both of them we have to add to the third paragraph of the Shema, which talks about remembering the day that we left Egypt. So we have this interesting passage based on a Mishnah, which reads in the Haggadah, that Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, Harei ani keven shivim shana, I am like 70 years old, and I haven't yet persuaded my friends to adopt this practice that we should mention the Exodus from Egypt twice a day. Acha drasha ben Zoyma, until ben Zoyma, who's one of the great Tanaim, came, and he based it on a pasuk, on a verse, and explained how the verse suggests halachically that we need to do it twice a day, and then it was accepted. So the obvious question, the famous question is, what does he mean when he says, Harei ani keven shivim shana? I am like 70 years old. In other words, although I'm like 70 years old, but I still can't persuade my friend. What do you mean I'm like 70 years old? So the famous interpretation is based on the Talmud. And the Talmud says that the story of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was the following. It was just after the destruction of the Second Temple. The Sanhedrin was being led by Rabban Gamliel, who was reading it very strongly and even a bit harshly. I'm summarizing the story. There came a point where it was decided that Rabban Gamliel needs to step down because it was being too harsh on some of the members of the Sanhedrin, and they wanted to appoint a new leader. All eyes turned upon Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. He was knowledgeable, he was great, he came from unbelievable descent, and he was just the fitting and the most qualified person. He says he needs to go home and consult with his wife. The problem with Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, he only had one weakness, one stain on his qualification, that was he was very young, he was 18 years old. So the Talmud says, he went home and he said to his wife, you know, this is the story, should I do it? So she says to him, but you look very young, maybe your youthfulness won't give you the stature, won't give you the influence that you need. And a miracle happens, says the Gemara, overnight his beard turned white, and he actually presented like a 70-year-old. This is the way it reads from the Gemara. The Maharal of Prague explains it a lot, and he asks the following question. Famous question, obvious question. If, in fact, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was 18 years old, and he wasn't really 70, that explains why he said, Hare ani keven shivim shana. I'm only like 70 years old. But yet I don't understand why I can't persuade my colleagues to adopt this practice of saying the third paragraph of Shema twice a day. So the Maharal asks, as everyone else does, well, if he was only 18, he's only like 70, so why is he so surprised that he cannot influence his colleagues? I mean, surely he must understand that he's only 18. And they knew that he was only 18. Okay, a miracle happened to him. He looks older. He looks like he's 70. That's great. But he's not 70. He's only a young guy. He's facing colleagues which were much older, much more experienced than him. So is it so surprising that he cannot influence his friends? So he says, well, we must say maybe the fact that his colleagues realize that he looks like 70, that should be enough for him to influence them. The Maharal then goes on to a very novel and creative approach, which other commentaries battle with because it doesn't seem to be consistent with the story as told by the Gemara. But he actually says that it didn't happen on the same day. In other words, this whole story where he said, I cannot influence my friends, wasn't on the day that he turned 18 and he looked like he was 70. But in fact, this happened much, much later. He was more than 50, he was like more than 50 years old, he'd already become a little bit older, his beard was even whiter, he looked even grayer, and therefore he was surprised that he looked like 70, he was close to 70, and he still couldn't influence his friends, and that surprised him. As I say, not everyone accepts that view because it's a bit difficult in terms of how you read the actual Gemara. It doesn't also sit with the... I'm just having a look here because the Rambam also has a very, very interesting very view. He says he wasn't really like 70. He was just because he learned so much and he was so steeped in his learning. That's why he looked a bit older, he looked a bit weaker. Again, also doesn't seem to fit with the reading of the Gemara. There are those that suggest that perhaps it's a dispute between the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud of how it all played out exactly. But I share with you one other thought that goes like this. Why was he surprised? He was surprised for the following reason. He was surprised because actually had the spiritual strength of 70. The Kabbalists tell us that Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah was a Gilgul, he was a reincarnation of Shmuel Hanavi, Samuel the prophet. Now, we know Samuel the prophet was an unbelievable tzaddik, and he passed away when he was 52. When Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah, who was the reincarnation, the Gilgul of Shmuel Hanavi, when he turned 18, he actually was spiritually 70 years old. He was like 70. He was spiritually 70. He had the power of being 70. Because he had the 52 years of Shmuel Hanavi, and he had the 18 years of himself, it made 70. The only problem was that true identity of the power that he really was didn't manifest itself in his physical features. So the miracle that God did to make him look like 70 was just actually to make him look like he really was. In other words, he looked 70 because in fact he had the spiritual power of being 70. And that's why he was surprised. He says, Arei ani kaven shivim shana. I look like 70 years old. In truth, I am 70 years old because I have the power of Shmuel as well. I have the previous Gilgal. I have that spiritual strength to have that influence, and yet I still can't seem to persuade my colleagues, and that's why he's surprised. That's a famous explanation based on Kabbalistic teachings. The Lubavitcher Rebbe once said a beautiful idea based on this that I want to share with you because it's a very important perspective in terms of how we view our own ability. He once said the following, that this is an amazing lesson for all of us to understand, because the Kabbalists, starting from the Arizal and onwards, tell us that nowadays, most of our souls have been here before. Most of our souls are actually Gilgal. Most of our souls come from previous souls, previous people that lived before us, and we've just come back to fix some of the process that we have to fix from the previous Gilgal. However, he says, what that teaches us from this story is, what that means is, that when we look at our own abilities in terms of spiritual growth, and we think they're limited, we have to understand we're not coming only with our own abilities. We're coming with the ability of all of those that came before us, all of those that were us in previous lifetimes. We're coming with a very strong dose of spiritual power that was here before us. We're standing on the shoulders of all those people that had our soul that came before us, just like Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah was on the shoulders of Shmuel Hanavi, of Samuel the prophet. However, he continued, it's not so simple. This concept that we have the spiritual strength of those who had our soul before us might be really good news for some, but might be really bad news for others. I'm not sure I want the strength of the guy who was here before me, who had my soul. Maybe he wasn't such a good guy. In the case of Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah, okay, the person who he was a Gilgal of was Shmuel Hanavi, Samuel the prophet. Obviously, so therefore it came together with Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah, the two together made this incredible, amazing power. But if I was a Gilgal of someone that just maybe didn't do such good things maybe I'm here to fix that. So I don't want that power. I want a clean slate. I don't want to ride on the soul that was here before me who had the person who was here before me who had my soul. Maybe it's not such good news. So he explained a beautiful idea. He said, no. Every person does good. And we have a principle that good is eternal. Bad is not eternal. When a person finishes their life on this world, there is a journey that a soul takes. And if there's anything negative that needs to be cleansed, it is cleansed, or whatever that, how that ever works, or the journey that the soul takes. We assist that soul, we do things in their memory, we learn in Mishnayos, or we say Kaddish, not now unfortunately, because no one is dominating with a minion, but we do things to assist the soul in that journey, and the soul goes through a cleansing process where any negative trace, any negative thing that was done is wiped away. What remains therefore? What remains therefore is only the good. And everyone has some good. So maybe the person who had my soul before me was much Shmuel Hanavi. Maybe he wasn't Samuel the prophet. Or he wasn't as great. But he was a person who did good for sure. I don't get the bad. I only get the good. And therefore when we sit down to the Seder and we want to experience freedom and we look at ourselves and we say, well, no, I'm stuck in who I am. My abilities are weak. I'm not that old spiritually speaking. I'm not that mature spiritually speaking. Remember the two things we said, Bechol Dor Vador, in every generation, just like the Jews were stuck and they managed to get out of Mitzrayim, God gave them the gift of freedom, we might be stuck, but we can tap into the energy of personal freedom, personal growth, particularly because we have extra strength. All the good that was done by the people who had our souls before us give us that extra strength and that spiritual age to be able to go beyond our comfort zone and to keep on growing and to take the next step and to experience personal freedom and to go out of our personal Egypt. Now, those are the couple of thoughts that I wanted to share with you. How do we experience freedom? By doing the mitzvot of the Seder, we tap into the energy and the gift of freedom. And one of those amazing mitzvot and what it stands for is the mitzvah of matzah. And I want to spend the remainder of the shiur exploring what the Haggadah has to say about matzah and go to it in a very deep way. Why do I say that? Because everyone watching here, I'm sure, if you were asked the question, why do we eat matzah on Pesach? You would reply with the most famous answer. And the famous answer is the answer that most of us learned in kindergarten. When the Jews left Egypt, they were in a very big rush and they didn't have time to bake bread that would rise. So they baked bread and the bread didn't rise because it was baked so quickly, and therefore we eat matzah in order to remember that concept, that freedom that they got, and it was rushed and didn't have time to bake bread that was rise, that rose. So that's the answer, that's the correct answer. That seems to be what the Haggadah is saying also. But you know, I'm sure everyone knows this answer, but it's always good to go a bit deeper into the answers that we learn in kindergarten. Like everything, you know, sometimes we rely on things that we learned when we were children and we don't always have the opportunity to go deep into it. I remember a story. I was once sitting in a group of people before Rosh Hashanah. I was having a discussion with someone and I was talking about Bina, what we do, and we teach and we learn, and emphasizing the importance of learning all the time. And he says to me, "No, I've learned. I've moved away from Jewish learning. Didn't talk to me. It wasn't deep enough. And I'm exploring other things," which of course sent me into a shock, because I mean, there's nothing more deeper than Torah learning, etc. So I wasn't sure how to answer him. So I said to him, "Can I ask you a question?" And he says, "Yeah." I said, "You know, it's coming up Rosh Hashanah. Why? And we're going to eat apple and honey." I said, "Why do we eat apple and honey?" So he says, "Well, because you know, apple and honey, sweet year, and all that kind of stuff." I said, "When did you learn that reason?" He says, "Oh, I don't know, from when I was a child." I said, "And that's it? You don't know anything more?" He says, "No, well, that's the reason we're always given." I said, "That's the problem. That's why you're leaving Jewish learning." I said, "You can't, when you're 45, rely on what you learned when you're in kindergarten. Because Torah is endless. And yes, the reasons are correct. The ones we were taught when we were children are correct. But there's so much more to it. And I want to take that reason that we all learned when we were young about matzah and really analyze it a bit and see, what does it really mean?" Because I'm gonna share with you a couple of problems. So the Haggadah says the following, and I know you probably don't have Haggadah in front of you, but I'm gonna quote. Because towards the end of the Haggadah, before the second cup, we talk about the three things that Rabbi Gamliel says we have to explore. And Rabbi Gamliel says the following: Matzah zu. We have to point to our matzah and we say, "This matzah, she'anu achlim al shuma, that we eat al shuma. Why do we eat it?" Now hear the phraseology here. Al shum ma, because of what? The word ma means what? Almost like a question. Al shum ma. So this is, on the surface, this is a question. Matzah zu, this matzah that we eat, al shum ma, because of what do we eat it? That's the question. Okay. And then it goes, says, al shum shula hispik betzeker shula vateinu lachmitz, because the dough of our forefathers didn't have time to rise. Achu nigla ale melach machal akadosh baruch hu galam, the King of Kings revealed to them and he redeemed them. Rashta ramitzrayim. It wasn't able to rise, and therefore we eat matzah to commemorate that. So first of all, I'm going to share with you two major questions. First question is, it's actually a strange thing, if we think about it, to actually say that we eat matzah because they baked bread when they were rushing out and it couldn't rise. If you look in the story of the Chumash, you will see that when the Jews left Egypt, before they left Egypt, they were commanded by Moshe Rabbeinu, in the name of God, to bring a Korban Pesach, to bring a Paschal Lamb on Erev Pesach, to roast it, to, yes, quarantine themselves, good word today, in their rehomes on the Pesach night, and to have what became known as the very first Seder. And they were supposed to eat the Korban Pesach, and they were told they have to eat matzah. And they were given the mitzvah of eating matzah on Pesach. Then, before they left Egypt, this was days before the day of Pesach. It was days before they woke up in the morning and Pharaoh got all frantic and he kicked them out of Egypt after the plague of the firstborn in the midnight. And It's days before the story when they baked bread quickly and the bread couldn't rise. They had already eaten matzah the night before as a commandment. And the commandment of eating matzah was already given. So what does it mean, therefore, that we eat matzah because the Jews baked bread which couldn't rise? We eat matzah because there's a commandment to eat matzah on the first night, which was given before that story. Question number one. Hold it there. Question number two needs a bit of analysis of the story. So, in Parashat Bo, where in Parashat Bo, where the story of Exodus is actually told, we know that the Jews lived in a place called Goshen. Now, I just need to tell you, my sense of geography, I don't have a sense of direction at all. And in school, one of the subjects that I battled with was geography. So I'm also very bad at biblical geography. So I might not be 1,000% accurate what I'm saying now, but this is the basic idea that comes out from the text. So the Jews lived in a place called Goshen. Goshen was a very large area. They had multiplied a lot, don't forget. There was millions of them. In fact, there was about 15 million Jews according to the calculation, because according to Rashi and Beshalach, 4/5 of the Jewish people actually died just before the Exodus, and about 3 million left. So that makes about 15 million people. And it was all impacted into a large area called Goshen. That was the place that the Jews lived. When they left Egypt, it says, Vayis'u b'nei Yisrael miRamses. The Jews left from a place called Ramses, and they went to a place called Sukkot. So, Vayis'u b'nei Yisrael miRamses Sukkotah. They went from Ramses to Sukkot. Now, Rashi does point out, Ramses is near Goshen, or a suburb of Goshen, and the Jews were all gathered from the whole of Goshen into this place called Ramses, where the Exodus, the journey of Exodus actually began. Now, you'll see where I'm going with this in a minute. This is very important to understand how matzah works. Rashi does point out here, he points out in Parashat Yitro mainly that this was done very quickly. To gather all the Jews from Goshen all to the place called Ramses, it was actually, Rashi says, I'll read you the phrase, Shayu Yisrael Mefuzarin, they were very scattered throughout the land of Goshen, and in a very short time, when they're about to travel, Nikpetsu Kolam LeRamses, they all gathered to Ramses, which is part of what the Pasuk says when God tells us that he took us out of Egypt on eagle wings. What does that mean? He took us out quickly. He gathered the people very, very quickly from Ramses, from the whole of Goshen to Ramses. Now, so it says they were in Ramses. They went from Ramses to Sukkot. Then it says, they arrived at Sukkot. Then it says, Vayofu et habatzek asher hotziu mimitzrayim. They baked the dough that they had taken out of Mitzrayim. Ugot matzot kilo chametz, and these were cakes of matzot, it wasn't chametz. Why? Ki gorshu mimitzrayim, because they were rushed out of Mitzrayim, v'lo yachlu lipameh, and they couldn't rise. V'gam tzedale asulahem, and they hadn't made any other provisions. So therefore, when they got to Sukkot, this is the simple reading of the Pasuk, when they got to Sukkot, they baked the dough that they had taken out of Mitzrayim, which says the Pasuk had managed to become Chametz because they left Mitzrayim quickly. Now, what comes out from the Pasuk, the verses, and I know I'm being a bit technical now, but you're going to see in a minute how relevant this is. The Jews gather from Goshen to Ramses. Pharaoh is urging them and he's kicking them out. They bake a quick dough. But it looks like, unlike we always think the story goes, it didn't bake in Ramses. It baked in Sukkot. In Sukkot, when they arrived at Sukkot, that's when they baked that dough, which creates a huge problem. What do you mean it didn't become chametz? We know if you have a dough, and the dough is left for 18 minutes, which is why matzah must be baked within 18 minutes, more than 18 minutes, which is the time of going a meal. A meal is a distance measurement. It's about, I think, 2/3 of a mile or something. Right, that's time it takes to walk. It's called hiluch mil, which is about 18 minutes. If dough is left for more than 18 minutes, it becomes chametz. How many mil was from Ramses to Sukkot? Rashi tells us, kuf half mil, 120 mil, 120 times 18 minutes from Ramses to Sukkot. And yet the Pasuk seems to say that they baked the dough that they had taken out of Mitzrayim, which means the dough that they made in Ramses. When they got to Sukkot, they baked that dough 120 times 18 minutes later. That would have made a huge chametz dough. So what do we mean? This whole concept that we always talk about, that it was rushed out and it was rushed and the whole thing, what does it mean that it became chametz? It's not my question. The Mefarshim, the commentaries, battle with this question. Perhaps there's a comment of Rashi that maybe addresses this question. Rashi says, Kuf chaf mil haya, it was 120 mil, and they came there very, very quickly. And that's also part of the process where God says, I took you out on eagle's wings. They got there very quickly. Which could be, as some of the Rishonim point out, was a miraculous event. The miraculous event was that they got there under 18 minutes, quickly baked the dough, and it wasn't chametz. All was rushed. In other words, they baked the dough, and Ramses, they were taken very quickly off to Sukkot. In Sukkot, they baked the dough, all under 18 minutes, a very, very miraculous event. The Orach Chaim, one of the great commentators in the Chumash, he has a different way of dealing with this. He also asks the question, he says there was much more time than 18 minutes between Ramses and Sukkot. He says, well, maybe there's a halakha that when do you say that the dough becomes chametz after 18 minutes? That's if you leave the dough idle. But if you knead the dough constantly, you work with the dough. If you work with the dough, it doesn't become chametz. So he says, well, maybe they had the dough in their hands and they kept on doing this. They kept on working with the dough. An interesting approach. I'm not sure exactly why they would do that and how that all works and so on, but that's an approach he takes also because of this problem. There is a view brought down more in the works of Hasidic philosophy and Kabbalah that actually, no, they might have gone quickly, perhaps miraculously quickly, from Ramses to Sukkot, but in fact it was more than 18 minutes. But it didn't become chametz. It didn't become chametz. Why didn't it become chametz? It was a kind of a miraculous event, but not just a miraculous event, there was a consequence. In other words, it was a physical miraculous event that although the dough stood more than 18 minutes, it didn't become chametz because of what was spiritually happening at the time. Let me explain. What does chametz represent? As we know, the concept of chametz represents ego. When a person is egocentric, when a person feels themselves, which is a consequence of a person not understanding that we are really nothingly, we are nothing independently, our whole existence depends on God, and we are actually part of a much greater force. We are part of God's power. We are part of God's creative energy. And in fact, we don't have any independence to ourselves. That doesn't make us unimportant, by the way. In fact, on the contrary, being part of God's existence makes us stronger and more powerful. But nevertheless, we're not an independent, out of God, so to speak, existence. We are really part of God's power. We are in God's hands. We are in God's control. And we follow God's code of morality, God's Torah, and so on and so forth. When we start doing our own thing, we detach from our godly awareness, we detach from our divine consciousness, then we have the concept of arrogance. So much so that the Gemara, the Talmud in Masechet Sota says that although God is pretty tolerant, there's one thing he's not tolerant of, and that is ego, arrogance. The Gemara in Sota says about a balgaiva, someone who's an arrogant person, that God says, Ein ani vahu yecholim ladur. I cannot coexist with such a person. Now, that's a really strange thing. God can coexist with the greatest sinners. He opens up the door of tshuva. He's able, he says, in there's the pasuk in Chumash where it says that God says, I will dwell with you even in your impurity. Even if you're impure, I'm still with you, I'm still there with you. So why all of a sudden someone who's arrogant is such a terrible sin that God says I cannot dwell with him? And the answer is very simple. Ego means that we're self-absorbed, we don't make room for others. That's how ego destroys relationships. But part of that is, not only do we make room for others, we don't make room for God either. Being egocentric, being arrogant means that we're unaware of God's presence. We're unaware of our dependence on God. We're not sensitive to the godly consciousness that should be part of who we are, our soul, our everything. Hashem Echad, the oneness of God that we say talk about every day in Shema, because God remains hidden to us to some degree. And that's why we start to focus on ourselves and be self-absorbed. And when we become self-absorbed, and if we let the arrogance and the ego take us over, we are unable to make room for anything else. We're unable even to make room for God, which is why God says, "Ein ani v'hu yichalim ladur." I cannot dwell with an arrogant person, because he doesn't invite me in. He doesn't make room for me. I'm prepared to be tolerant and give room and forgive and compassionate and live with a sinner and you know, acknowledge human shortcomings, but only if the person acknowledges me and invites me in. Chametz, as we know, the difference between chametz and matzah, chametz is a symbol of ego. The number one ingredient, the foundation of experiencing internal freedom is to surrender. How are we able to go beyond ourselves? How are we able to grow? How are we able to go beyond our comfort zone? How come we're not stuck in ourselves? Why? Because we surrender to something higher. We let go of ourselves and we surrender to a godly power. We surrender to God. That's what matzah is. Matzah is humility. Matzah doesn't mean that we self-negate in a negative sense. Matzah means that we let go of everything that's tying us back. We let go of ourselves. We don't take ourselves that seriously. We stop being self-absorbed and we give ourselves over. We give our process, our experience over into God's hands. And when we let Him run the show, He's infinite and He allows us to grow. He gives us that spirit of infinity. He allows us to take that next step and to grow beyond our own definition, to go beyond ourselves, to be, so to speak, infinite within our own experience. That's an amazing thing. That's the power of freedom, to make choices, to overcome our shortcomings, to overcome our own incarceration, to free ourselves from ourselves. That can only be when we let go of our ego and we give ourselves over to God. That's positive surrender when we give ourselves over to the one above. So, chametz represents the ego, the barrier to growth, the barrier to freedom. Matzah represents humility, surrender to God, giving up. In fact, just to add this in, there's a famous idea. The Maharal of Prague says a very beautiful idea. He says that we know that matzah is a bread of freedom. You know, at the Seder, we do certain things to remember freedom. We do certain things to remember the slavery. So we know, like maror, a bit of herbs is to remember the slavery and so on. But matzah, we know clearly, is a symbol of freedom, and that's why we lean when we eat the matzah. Says the Maharal, how does that fit in with the fact that the matzah is referred to as lechem oni, poor man's bread? That's why we break the matzah. That would be like a poor person doesn't have a full loaf of bread. Say, matzah is a symbol of freedom, so why do we make a bread of a poor man? Poverty is a negative thing. Says the Maharal, poverty is not always a negative thing. There's negative poverty and positive poverty. Yes, when someone doesn't have what to eat, someone doesn't have what they need, that's negative poverty. But there's a spiritual poverty, which is the good poverty. As King David says in Tehillim, Tfilah le'ani, there's a powerful prayer that comes from a prayer of someone that's poor. What does that mean? Positive poverty, says the Maharal, is to let go of everything that we have. Everything that is part of ourselves, so we can surrender to something greater. To let go of ourselves. To let go of our self-consciousness in a negative way. When we let go of everything that's holding us back, we become clean. We become pure. We become positively poverty-stricken. That's why the matzah is lechem oni, because it's the true symbol of freedom. It's letting go of everything that's got to do with our own ego, and therefore completely surrendering to something higher. Positive poverty, poor man's bread, that's the key to personal freedom and to spiritual freedom. So matzah is humility, surrender. Chametz is ego. Now, we say in the Haggadah, quoting a pasuk dealing with how God redeemed the Jewish people, that we say, Uvamara gadol, God redeemed the Jewish people with great awesomeness. And then we explain in Haggadah, and we said that what happened was that when God made the Jewish people free, which according to the Zohar, there was the defining moment of freedom, which was midnight. Nigla aleihem melech malchei amlochem HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There was this incredible divine revelation that was revealed to the Jewish people. Even though they weren't ready for it, they didn't deserve it necessarily. They were stuck in the 49th level of impurity, as we explained before. But yet, when the moment came for Exodus, God revealed Himself in the most awesome way. He revealed His essence, He revealed His true infinity in His full glory, in His full awesomeness. Uvamara gadol, says the Haggadah. He revealed himself to the Jewish people. When that revelation took place, freedom, true freedom, was a given, because there was no room for ego. In other words, at that level of spiritual revelation, ego just dissipated. Ego just disappeared. It wasn't even something they had to work on at that stage. There was no room for any ego. Once God is revealed, everything else disappears. Everything else cannot stand in the way. The ego of the human is no match to a godly revelation. When God revealed himself in Mitzrayim at that moment, there was an obvious freedom. It was a gift from above. It was a gift that God was giving us. But there was obvious freedom. Freedom was a given. Ego had no room. There was an inability to have any ego at that stage. So therefore, when the revelation took place at midnight in Mitzrayim and during the process of the Exodus, ego was impossible. Ego was impossible. So now let's understand. According to the Kutei Torah, this is how it works. The dough that they baked at Ramses, sorry, the dough that they made at Ramses, which they only baked in Sukkot, might very well have been lying there for more than 18 minutes. But yet it didn't become chametz. Why? Chametz is a symbol of ego. At that stage, the energy in the air, there was no ego. There was a divine revelation. When there was divine revelation spiritually, it even had an effect on the physical baking of the matzah, and the dough was able to stand more than 18 minutes, and it simply, not it couldn't become chametz, it simply didn't become chametz. Because the intensity of the spiritual revelation meant that there was no ego. If there was no ego that manifested itself even in the baking of the bread, the dough just didn't rise. The dough just didn't rise. Because there was no work to be done. You didn't have to rush to write to do it before. The rushing that they were rushed out of Mitzrayim has a different connotation, have a different meaning. It means they were rushed out by God. And they were so swept up by the revelation that it was impossible for them to have any ego. And therefore, it actually didn't rise. Not it couldn't rise, but it didn't rise, even though it was more than 18 minutes. Now, what's that got to do with our matzah? You see, our matzah is a bit different. Because our matzah, we do have to rush and make it under 18 minutes. Why? Because we don't have that divine revelation. We have a special energy, a special gift on Pesach, yes. But we don't have that amazing, full-blown, in all the glory, spiritual revelation happens on Pesach night, that giving up our ego becomes an obvious thing. Why don't we have? For a very good reason, because God only gave it to us as a real gift once. Because now he wants us to work on it. He wants us to work on getting rid of our ego. He wants us to make the choice to be free. However, on Pesach, he helps us along. He asks us to bake matzah. He asks us to bake matzah, which nowadays needs work. It needs protection. Shmurah, we need to guard the matzah, make sure it doesn't become chametz. But God says, when you eat matzah that I command you to eat on the first night of Pesach, I connect that matzah that you eat to the matzah that they baked in Egypt. To the matzah that they baked in Egypt. The matzah you eat is a recipe for surrender. It's a recipe for humility. That humility is not going to come automatically. You need to work on it. But it's with the support of the matzah. Matzah is like an infusion of godly energy, which will give you humility. It will give you the ability to surrender. Eating the matzah on Pesach night, the great sources tell us, is like eating spirituality. The Zohar says it's bread of faith. It's bread that we eat, that we ingest. Emunah, faith. It brings healing, spiritual healing, physical healing, which we all need now. Eating the matzah on Pesach night actually gives us an amazing ability to be connected to God. It gives us the amazing ability to surrender to God, to be humble, to get rid of our ego. It's not going to happen automatically today. Today we have to, yes, also work at it. But we're given tremendous support on Pesach by that infusion of freedom which we experience on Seder night. Having put that all together, now we're going to have a look back at the paragraph of the Haggadah and figure it all out. Let's go. It starts by saying, Matzah zu, this matzah, she'anu ochlim mashum ma. Because of what? Because of ma. Because of what do we eat it? So we said before, it's a question. I'm going to turn it into a statement. It's not a question, it's a statement. The word ma is a reference to complete humility and complete surrender. How do I know this? Many, many sources. One of them is an example. In Parashat Beshalach, when the Jews complained against Moshe and Aaron that they're not giving meat, they're not providing meat, and they only have the man and the whole thing. They were desperate for meat and the quails, the whole story. Moshe Rabbeinu turns to the Jewish people and he says, in the morning you will see the glory of God because he has heard your complaints. He has heard your complaints against God. Now, in fact, they haven't complained against God. They complained against Moshe and Aaron, really. Says Moshe Rabbeinu, your complaints is not against me, it's against God. Why? Because v'nachnu ma. What are we? We are nothing. Ma, we are just, ma means like, what are we? In other words, Moshe and Aaron were at the greatest level of humility, of what we call in the Hasidic sources, bitul, self-negation, positively, self-surrender. At the highest level of bitul, as we know, that later on in the Chumash, we are told that Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest, most humble person that ever existed. And he says about himself, v'nachnu ma, I'm not independent at all. I don't do anything outside of God. I'm completely in God's hands. And therefore, your complaint against me is a complaint against God. Because Moshe Rabbeinu was at, really, the highest level of ma, of bitul, of what is a complete self-surrender. So, I want to point out, there's many sources for this, but the word ma is a reference to humility, a reference to surrender. Says the Haggadah, matzah zu, this matzah we eat, sha'anu achlim, we eat it, al shum ma, it is because of ma. It is because we want to go out of our own Egypt. We want to surrender. We want to achieve humility. We want to let go of our ego. We want to let go of that stuff that is standing in the way of our personal freedom, our spiritual freedom. We're eating it al shum ma. Now, how does the matzah that we eat got to do with humility? How's the matzah got to do with the fact that the Jews left Egypt and they baked bread? We know the Jews were already commanded to eat matzah the night before, as we were. It's already a mitzvah before the story. Says the Haggadah, yes, true. But the matzah that we are commanded to eat connects to the matzah that they baked in Egypt. And the baked in Egypt, we continue, Ashum shlo hispik betzeket shel avoteinu l'achmetz. The dough that our forefathers baked wasn't able to become chametz. Now again, according to this new interpretation, what does it mean it wasn't able to come to become chametz? Not because it was less than 80 minutes. It was because it couldn't become chametz. Why, says the Haggadah? Achenigla aleihem melech malchei ha'malachim ha'kadosh baruch hu. Because God revealed himself to them and redeemed them. That's what it means. Not just talking about the events that it couldn't become chametz because God had revealed himself and they were rushed out of Egypt. It's explaining. It's explaining why that chametz couldn't become, that dough couldn't become chametz, because God had revealed himself in his full glory. God had revealed a full-blown divine revelation. And because of that, there was no room for ego. And because there was no room for ego, the bread, the dough simply, it manifested itself in a very tangible way that the dough simply didn't rise. And therefore, the matzah that we eat, says the Haggadah, although we just commanded to do it, the mitzvah was given even before the matzah, but yet, the matzah we eat connects to that matzah. And although we don't have the full-blown revelation, but it's infused in the matzah. And the matzah, and we do have to make sure it's baked in under 18 minutes. But nevertheless, says the Haggadah, the matzah we eat is connected to that matzah. And therefore, it gives us the ability, it gives us an infusion of energy to let go of our ego, to reflect on what the matzah stands for, to let go of who we are, and to surrender, complete surrender, positive poverty, as the Maharal says, to become connected to God and to experience our own personal and spiritual freedom. So that gives us an explanation of what the Haggadah says. It explains the problem of the dough not becoming chametz, and also gives us an amazing deep insight onto how powerful the mitzvah of matzah is. The mitzvah of matzah that we eat connects back to that matzah which they baked. That matzah couldn't become chametz, not didn't become chametz, but could have, even though it was longer than 18 minutes, as according to this interpretation, because it had that. It was part of that whole full-blown divine revelation where ego became impossible, and therefore even on the physical level, it could not become chametz. Our matzah needs more work, but our matzah connects to that matzah, and therefore we eat it al shum ma, because of ma. We want to achieve ma. We want to achieve humility, and we can do that because it's connected to that matzah, which didn't become chametz. Why, says the Haggadah, achenigla aleihem, because God revealed himself, and he redeemed them. And that energy of redemption re-happens every Pesach night. We can tap into it by experiencing the Seder with all the mitzvot. So remind everyone, of course, about the important mitzvah of eating a kazayit, at least one kazayit of shmura matzah on each person on Seder night, together with all the other mitzvot, maror, telling the story, drinking the four cups of wine, and we do that, we tap into that energy of freedom, and hopefully God will give us that ability to move forward and actually take the next step and to truly experience personal freedom, to make the right choices, to understand that we cannot control anything outside of us, but we can control our response to the world. We can control our moral decisions, we can control our mitzvot, we can control our emotional responses to what happens outside of us, and we can be positive, and we can be spiritual, and we can make those choices to serve God, each in our own way, by taking the next step beyond our own comfort zone, and God then will see that we're not just going through the motions of the Seder, but we're actually really experiencing the Seder. We're trying to tap into the energy of freedom and applying it to our own life, the hold of our door in every generation, no matter how low we might be, but we have that gift of freedom given to us on that night of Pesach, and God will accept our Seder, and hopefully assist us and support us in our journey to own personal and spiritual freedom, but also to really give us the ultimate gift, the gift of the ultimate redemption with Mashiach, which will be the ultimate redemption, b'mehera b'yameinu. I want to wish everyone, thanks for, first of all, for watching and listening. I want to give everyone a blessing to have a really, really good Pesach. And as I mentioned before, the Zohar says that the matzah is bread of faith, but also bread of healing. Those who need healing should have healing. The whole world needs healing really at the moment. Let us experience the healing. Let us be able to go beyond and out of the current situation, but not just to back to normal, but back to a much better, more powerful journey of spirituality and freedom and healthy living, both physically and spiritually, and merit to the ultimate geula, b'mehera b'yameinu. Chag Sameach, and thanks so much for watching, and have a great day.